Thanks a lot, Mark. Okay, see if we can get this right. Okay, so is Dan Moses still here? I didn't see him anywhere. But I just wondered if I could upset more people in the audience than Dan did. So that's my mission today. So the question is, you know, is current DNA technology worthwhile? Is it something that you guys ought to be thinking about and using? I think it's certainly something you ought to be thinking about. And what I'm really here to do today is to tell you why, what's coming down the pike. Ronnie Green talked a little bit about that yesterday. I'm going to talk a lot more about that, and I think your world may be changing faster than almost any of us can deal with it. But my point right now is to reinforce what Luke said. The technology that we have available right now isn't worth your while. So why not? Why isn't it worth your while? I think there are several reasons. One of those is that each trait for which we have a DNA marker, that DNA marker explains relatively small amounts of variation within the trait. And one of the things I want to try to get you to think about today, and if you leave here thinking only this, I will have been successful. And that is that a DNA marker that tests for a single gene that influences a trait like marbling is like having an EPD with an accuracy of 5%. Right? And I'm going to prove this to you in a little while. So my question to you is, how much would you pay to get an EPD with an accuracy of 5%? You pay $50 for that? Maybe not. So that's the way I want you to think about DNA markers, individual DNA markers for individual traits. Another problem we've got with DNA markers is that we just don't have them for all the traits that are economically important. What about feed efficiency? What about longevity? What about fertility? We just don't have DNA markers for some of these traits. And so that's another big impediment. The data are starting to trickle to the breed associations, but the breed associations in general are not using that data to compute EPDs. So you're actually not getting the value from having that genotypic data, and that's an important issue. And finally, they just cost too much. You just can't, in my opinion, afford to spend $50 on a test that's like buying an EPD with an accuracy of 5%. So what I really want to do for the rest of this talk is tell you something about the impediments that we faced, the researchers that have faced in this area. And two of the things are, I want to explain to you why there are so few tests that are currently available. I want to tell you about how many tests I think we need to explain large amounts of variation in these traits. And I want to tell you about this new technology that's coming spinning down the pike that I think may have the opportunity to address these issues for us. It's called whole genome selection. And I think it has the ability to make this technology cost effective for you guys. So this is the slide that I wanted to show you, how many genes there are we need to test for. So my group at the University of Missouri has been doing a study in an Angus population. We've got about 5,000 DNA samples from the Circle A Ranch. We've got about 1,800 DNA samples from AI Angus bulls, for which the Angus Association have provided us EPDs, accuracies, pedigrees on animals that go back into the 1800s. And we've now genotyped 4,000 of these animals for 422 microsatellite markers. And it took us over a year to do that to generate 1.6 million genotypes. And in our analysis of those data, here's one of the results we've got. This is marbling score in Angus. Now, the x-axis, the bottom axis there, is the genome. Let me see if I can point this out to you. So going this way, this is chromosome 1, right here, chromosome 2, all the way down to the X chromosome there. And what you see is a series of bars. So look at the purple ones. I hope you can see purple on that, right? There's two different colors there. The purple ones say if we apply a really strict statistical threshold, right, p less than 0.05 on a whole genome scale, what evidence do we get that there are genes that influence marbling in Angus? And you can't count them, but there are 59 purple bars on that graph. 59. And that tells me that there are something like 60 genes in Angus that are responsible for the differences in marbling, the genetic differences in marbling score and marbling EPD. So that means we need 60 tests, right? We need to be able to test for all 60 of these, not just one, not just two, all 60 of these within Angus if we're going to do something really effective. So that's point one. I want to take a look at this particular one. This is in the middle of chromosome 14, and we didn't pick on this. I can't even get this thing pointed right. Okay, so I didn't pick on this for any other reason other than I already had a figure made up. So this is a gene that's right in the middle of chromosome 14 that has an effect on marbling score. And what I'm interested in is I've got 59 genes that I have to make a test for, right? So I can deliver that to you guys. So how do I do that? Well, I do it one at a time. So I start with this one, say, for no other reason than it's the one right in the middle of the chromosome, in the middle of the genome. So I want to make a test for that. How do I do it? Well, what I do is I go to the families that tell me that there's a gene there, and that's what this figure shows. These are the families that segregate for that gene. That's the bull is a heterozygote, so it's a plus minus, right? There's one that increases marbling, one that decreases marbling. And it tells me right in the middle of that chromosome is where that gene is. So I say, okay, I want to make a test for that. Let's go to the genome sequence. You all know that we've got a genome sequence for cow now. That's like a 28 million piece jigsaw puzzle. Right? It's exactly what it is. 28 million little pieces of sequence put together in a jigsaw puzzle, and right now that jigsaw puzzle isn't together very well. But if you go to that region of the genome and you have a look at the genes that are present within that region, there's lots of them. There's lots of them. So how do I know which is the one that is causing that variation? I don't. I've got no idea. I can make an educated guess. I can kind of look at them. There's something over here that's called fatty acid binding protein 4. It's got fatty in its name. That sounds like it might be associated with marbling. So let's take a look at that. Let's sequence that. And whenever you do that, what you find is you never find the real mutation that's causing the effect, right? You're just guessing. You're shooting in the dark. And the problem we've got is right now, right today, we don't have a real effective way to go into this region of this chromosome in my Angus bulls, right, and sequence them to find out where that point is. We don't have an effective way. And that's the simple reason that we have so few tests that are out there right now. Because we can find these genes, we can do the mapping, we can find them. I know there's 60 or 59 that influence marbling, but I don't know what the genes are. And it's really, really tough to be able to get in there and identify those individual genes and make tests for them. And that's why we've been hampered to this point, making this technology work. So some of the impediments that we've had as scientists and as an industry are this. So first of all, we haven't genotyped large enough populations to find all these genes. Is it kind of news to anyone out there that there are 60 genes that influence marbling in Angus? Hands up if that's news to you. Well, you know, you're all pretty good genomicists. You already told me that earlier on in the day. Well, it's news to me. I mean, we've done some studies, and lots of other groups, Clay Center, have done studies where they've all found evidence for individual genes, but they find 4 or 5 per study. And the reason that they only find 4 or 5 per study is that they just don't genotype enough animals, big enough populations, to find all of the genes that are squirreled away, creating variation in those populations. So let's say there's 60 genes that create variation in all these traits. How many traits are important to you guys? Well, Angus publishes EPDs on 17 traits for which they actually collect phenotypes. And there's a whole bunch of traits they don't collect phenotypes on. It'd be nice if we had warmer brass or shear force and feed efficiency and sensory evaluation. So we could get up to 20 pretty quick. Well, multiply that by the 60 genes that cause variation in each of those traits. We are talking about needing 1,200 tests, DNA tests, to make this stuff really effective for you. Okay? It's taken us 15 years to get to about 5. So how long is it going to take us to get this job done? Maybe forever, but maybe not. So the other real tough thing is that it's easy for us, or it's relatively easy for us, to find the regions on the genomes that these genes are in, but it's very difficult to identify the actual variable point, the mutation that causes the effect. So these are the impediments, and let me reiterate, there are lots of genes. That's the biggest impediment. So let's suppose that we could actually find tests for all 59 of those genes. What would happen? Well, this is what you guys do right now, right? This is Chuck Henderson from Cornell. And Chuck Henderson was the father of BLUP and mixed model analysis. He's the guy that made all your EPDs possible. He's the guy that came up with this theory that says we can take relationship information, we can take traits measured on cattle in the fields, and we can come up with estimates of breeding value, or EPDs, this thing right here. And what he was actually doing statistically is actually estimating the value of all of the marbling genes present within the genome of each of those animals. So he was going through and saying, okay, there's this guy, I've got 3 marbling genes out of this 59 indicated. So what are you there? Are you good-good or good-bad or bad-bad? And if I add up those effects across all of the marbling genes in the genome, guess what? That's what that is. That's what you come up with, an EPD. I can't get this thing pointed right. Right, that's what you come up with, an EPD. So the question is, can we do that another way? Can we actually tackle that from a molecular perspective? Is there a way that we can come up with an indirect measure of all of those genes without having to identify them and identify the specific causal points that make the effects on marbling score? And to get to that, I've got to talk about SNPs, introduce SNPs to you. So SNP stands for single nucleotide polymorphism, and it's kind of snappy, SNPs. And there's lots of them in the genome. There's like one in a cow genome or a human genome. They occur like every 100 bases. So about 1% of the genome is variable from the perspective of these single points. And so this shows 4 different chromosomes right up there. So there's chromosome 1, 2, 3, and 4 out of different individuals, right? And what you see is that most of these points are not variable because there's only about 1 in 100 that is. And then all of a sudden, you start hitting these points that are variable, and that's a SNP. So an A changes to a G or something like that within the population. And if you collect all those variable points on these chromosomes and ignore the stuff in the middle that's not variable, you come up with these things that are called haplotypes. And this describes all of the variability that exists within a population of animals. So SNPs are pretty cool for lots of reasons. You can do exactly the same thing with SNPs as we've been doing with microsatellites. You can do parentage. You can do traceability. You can do genetic testing using these things. Individually, they're not as informative as microsatellites. So it's going to take like 5 or 10 times the number of these markers if you want to do parentage, for example. But it turns out they're really much easier and much cheaper to genotype. And that's been a big limitation of microsatellite technology in this population. And a group of 4 of us, myself at the University of Missouri, 2 groups from within the USDA IRS, so Clay Center, Tim Smith at Clay Center, and Kurt Van Tassel and Pat Sonstegard up at Beltsville, as well as Steve Moore up in Canada, have just put $2.5 million and 6 months of our lives into doing this thing, building this thing. This thing has the potential to revolutionize everything that we're doing in cattle genomics. And what it is, it's a chip that will score 50,000 SNPs in one assay. 50,000 SNPs in an individual in one particular assay, one single assay. And it looks like a glass slide, doesn't it? And that's because it is a glass slide. But that glass slide has got 12 different slots on it. Each of those slots is where I put a DNA sample from an animal. And each of those little tiny channels on that slide will get me these 50,000 SNPs. And we just submitted the SNP list. There's actually 58,343 SNPs that have been put on this chip. And on Wednesday, right before I drove to St. Louis to come here, we pulled the trigger on this and sent this list to Illumina, and they're building this for us right now. This is going to be available to this consortium at the end of August, August 24th, and it's going to be available to the rest of the world in December. And we think that the price is going to be $208 for each one of these chips to the world. So this just shows you what chromosome 1 looks like. That looks like radio noise, right? Radio signal noise. But this is what this is. It's how 3,350 SNPs are distributed along chromosome 1. So cow chromosome 1 has got 146 million DNA bases on it. And every 500,000, we have an average of 12 SNPs. And the important thing about this slide is there's no big holes. So there's no region on this chromosome that we don't have really well covered with lots and lots of SNPs. So what's this going to be useful for? It's going to be useful for a lot of things. This shows you an analysis that we did, not with this chip, because this chip's not built yet, but we've been fooling around with SNPs for some time. And we built an assay, and this is chromosome 14, that had 518 SNPs on it, and we ran it in 68 Angus bulls. And these Angus bulls have marbling EPDs where they actually have progeny, right? So they actually have direct estimates of their marbling EPD based upon progeny. And then what we did was said, can we detect any signal for whether or not we can detect a marbling gene on chromosome 14? And we know there's three there already, right? And what do we find? In these 68 animals, there's two places on this chromosome where we're getting really strong signal. This is 68 animals. This isn't thousands. This is 68 animals. And we get very strong signal up here, a little less strong signal down here. We're picking up strong signal for the presence of these genes. So what this guy says right up here is, well, what if I took the SNPs that are in this region right here and I arranged them as haplotypes in all of these animals, in all of these bulls, and I tried to say, what's the value, what's the contribution of having that haplotype to your EPD? Can I predict the contribution of this gene to this bull or to all bull Angus bulls' EPDs based upon the little signature, the DNA signature or the haplotype that exists in that region? And that's what whole genome selection is all about. Whole genome selection says if we could get a big bunch of animals and if we could genotype 50,000 SNPs across that big bunch of animals, and then what we would do is divide the region up, the genome up into little blocks, and each of those blocks has got 16 SNPs in it. And we'll use those blocks, the haplotypes in those blocks, to do two things. We're going to look for where the genes are. So here's the marbling genes. There's one there, there's one there, there's one there. And look at the color code over here. That's a heat map. That says we can detect the presence of those genes by those haplotypes, the blocks that are there, and more importantly, the individual haplotypes at that point on the chromosome will help me predict the EPD of those animals. And that's conceptually what whole genome selection is all about. So what it is, it's a way to estimate total genetic merit, EPD of an animal, without having any phenotypic data. You don't need phenotypic data. If you know what the animal's genotype is at very high density in the genome, you can predict its EPD with accuracy. No one's proven yet that this actually works. And this is very new theory, and there are lots of groups all over the world running down this road. There's some Aussies in this room that have actually done more work on this than anybody else. And some early published results in dairy cattle from an Australian group showed this, that they, in Holsteins, were able to predict EPDs for milk traits using their molecular signatures and correlate that with the EPD from daughter milk production. And the correlation between those was 81%. That's pretty impressive. That means you can get an 81% correlation between a high accuracy EPD produced from phenotypes with just a DNA signature. Wow. Pretty impressive. So the other things that are impressive about this technology is it's not single gene. It's doing every gene that influences marbling simultaneously, every gene that influences feed efficiency simultaneously. Every gene for every trait is what this technology could work for. Single test. You just need to do one test. You don't have to send DNA to 15 different companies. You just do one test, you've got it all. You've got everything in one test. You also have things like parentage. You know, if you do this early enough in an animal's life, the genotypes will tell you parentage. It'll also allow you to create a database that you can use for traceability. It's got enormous downstream applications. We're doing a test run on this in collaboration with the Angus Association. In fact, probably starting August 25th after our chips turn up. So we're going to take those 1,768 Angus bulls that I've got in my freezer. My herd doesn't take as much room as your guys. I just keep them in a deep freezer and pull them out when I need them. And I'm going to take those and we're going to genotype them with this chip. And then what we're going to do is test. We're going to generate 88 million genotypes. It's probably going to take us about 2 weeks to do that. All right? And we're going to generate all those genotypes and we're going to test whether or not we can predict EPDs for all 17 traits for which you guys have produced phenotypes on these Angus bulls. So we'll know by the end of the year whether or not this technology has promise for this in beef cattle. So what if it works? I honestly believe it's going to work. I'm very optimistic about this. As I told you, we're doing this as a collaborative project with American Angus, And we've just submitted a USDA grant. So if there's anybody in the crowd that's going to be on the review panel this year for the USDA, be looking out for this and make sure you give us the money, okay? So this is an integrated grant where what we're going to do is work with Sally and Bill. They're co-PIs on the grant. And what we're going to try to do is figure out what are the impediments to make this technology work. And there are statistical and theoretical things we've got to work around. So, for example, what do you do with all the legacy animals in your data set? They've got phenotypes, but they're never going to get genotyped. And then you're going to have some animals that have phenotypes and genotypes. And then you've got animals that are just going to have genotypes. Well, as John Pollock said yesterday, that's all got to be combined into one thing, an EPD. But you've got to have an accuracy. And that's what's going to be important. How does it influence the accuracy of those animals' EPDs? We've got lots of things to look at from the association point of view. What does it mean to them in terms of their data pipeline, data management, software development, getting genotypes in from the companies that do the genotyping on this? What have they got to do to actually make this effective? What traits do they have available? Well, they've got 17 that we've got EPDs on. The Angus Association has also made available to us the Carcass Merit Project samples. So we've got Warner Bradshaw Shear Force, and we've got sensory panel evaluations. I also have 813 Angus steers that I've rounded up. We have individual animal feed intake on. So maybe we can add a few more important traits to this mix. The big, important potential downside to this technology is that I think it's going to be breed-specific. So I think that the genes that create variation are the same in every breed, right? So those locations on the chromosome where I showed you there were 59 marbling genes, that's the same. It doesn't matter if you're Angus or Hereford or Charolais, that's the same. What's going to be different is the haplotypes. So the little fingerprints that you get in those regions of the genome, we've already shown this, are really different between different breeds. So the tool that I generate to do this in Angus won't work when I apply it to Soleil because the fingerprint's going to be different. So that, what that means is if this is going to be effective, we're probably going to have to take this technology and repeat the analysis, do the genotyping in all of the breeds that want to pony up and get on board. So that's going to be a real issue to this technology. We don't know how long it's going to work for. It's an indirect measure of the genes, because it's just a fingerprint in that region. So the question is it going to last for 10 years, 20 years, 40 years before we have to redo the analysis? I think it'll actually last longer than we think. I don't think that's really going to be an issue, but we don't know the answer to that. I think there are going to be real significant IP issues. If this works and we license this technology to one company, let's say we license this to Bovigen, and they come up with a test that explains 98% of the genetic variation in 17 traits in Angus, what does that mean to all the other companies that are trying to market tests, competing tests, if they don't have access to this technology? Some real IP issues and licensing and marketing issues that I think have to be considered. What's the cost going to be? Well, I can tell you that for research purposes, Illumina is going to try to sell this thing for $208 a chip when it comes out December. I know that they can sell it for a lot less than that, but you've got to buy a lot of chips. So what if this industry and the dairy industry, the U.S. dairy industry is going down this road as fast as we're going down this road, what if we formed a consortium through, say, NAAB, and we went to Illumina and we said, we want to buy 50,000 of these things this year. What are you going to charge us for it? Can you get this down to, say, $40 a test? So now if you're talking about that, and now you talk about a genotyping lab providing you that test, would it be worth spending maybe $100 on a test that explained 98% of the variation in 20 traits? I think so. But these are the issues that we have to try to face. I think we got some really strange things coming our way, too. I've been thinking about this. What if you got these two bulls here, and these two bulls have a marbling gene, and they have a tenderness gene right next to each other, and they have this bull has a plus and a negative allele. It's a heterozygote, right? So it's a one-star versus, a one-star is what you'd call that. And this bull over here is the same. So they're both heterozygous, so they're genetically equivalent for that gene. And the one right next to it, under here, they're both heterozygotes, right? So they're genetically equivalent for those two genes, right? But have a look at this. This bull over here has the plus alleles on one chromosome, the one that it inherited from its dad, and the negative alleles on the other chromosome, and the other one is kind of jumbled up. Would either of those bulls be more desirable to you in a breeding program? I tell you which one I'd take. I'd take this one every day. 50% of the progeny are going to get this chromosome with the two negative alleles on it, and they're not going to be real good. But the other 50% are going to get both of the positive alleles. So we've got to start thinking about different things, about how we're going to implement this technology within breeding programs. Well, what if it doesn't work? You guys haven't been laughing at my slides. You're really bumming me out up here. Come on, I got some funny pictures in there, and you're trying to be real serious here. So what if it doesn't work? I think it's going to work. I really think this technology is going to work, but it wouldn't be the first time that I've seen the wheels come off something and had some pretty negative downstream consequences. But you know, working in a biotech startup with Luke, when Luke and I crossed over to the dark side, taught me something. And what it really taught me is you really need to have a plan B. Right? You really need to have a plan B. And I got a plan B. And if any of you are interested and you come to the emerging technology talk this afternoon, I'll tell you about the plan B. And the importance of the plan B is that it doesn't suffer from these problems of only working within a breed. So if we do this study within Angus, and it only works in Angus, boy, it doesn't help the rest of you, does it? We've got to find a way to solve that problem. And that's what Plan B is all about. So these are the guys who have done all the work. I get to travel around and make these talks. These guys do the work. I really have to acknowledge the USDA, CSIRES, that have put millions of dollars into the work that I've just shown you today, and made all of this possible. And so thanks very much.